welcome back. This is Media Talk. Coming up in this week's podcast,
there's a real concern now that things like courts and councils and public authorities are just not going to be covered. The fear, which is pretty widespread in America now, is that that will lead to an era of corruption.
With a crisis in local news, Guardian editor Alan Rusbridger calls for public subsidy. Straight in at number one, the Daily Mail hits the top spot in the website hit parade. And
bloody, the Apprentice.
The BBC Trust says Lord Sir Alan's Apprentice mustn't clash with the general election. Is it a case of you're suspended? I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, in the week that it's been revealed that journalism is the most exclusive middle-class profession of the 21st century, we have two of the trade's most gritty examples of salt-of-the-earth types here. Janine Gibson is executive editor of Guardian.co.uk. Put that mug of Bovril down, Janine. Are you feeling middle-class today, or are you your working-class roots?
I am the very epitome of middle-class.
You are. Stephen Brook is Media Guardian's press and publishing correspondent. Is it possible, Stephen, to be elite and Australian at the same time?
Well, I'm not descended from a convict, so I've been led to believe by my parents, but the descendant of a free settler.
Excellent. Well,
I'm from the North Shore of Sydney, so
what does that mean?
I think that means middle class.
Okay. Well, more on class coming up, but we'll get things moving this week with a word from the top.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Another week, another speech to the Media Standards Trust. Hot on the heels of FT editor Lionel Barber's words 7 days ago on the future of online, Alan Rusbridger, the Guardian's editor-in-chief, said the collapse of local news would lead directly to more corruption in local government. And he backed a call for public funding to Britain's National Press Agency. The Press Association is currently looking for cash to trial the idea of public service local journalism, starting in Merseyside in the northwest of England. Earlier, I asked Alan Rusbridger to elaborate on his thoughts, and we began by discussing the crisis in local news and, by implication, the problems for local democracy.
Everyone is waking up to the fact that the local press is in desperate trouble, really, and also ITV local news. I think if you look forward some years, possibly even some months, you're going to be in a situation where an awful lot of the things that we took it for granted used to be covered, like councils, like courts, like health authorities, fire services, ambulance services, I mean, all the bits of democracy that we rely on and expect our local papers to cover are not going to be covered. I'm not totally gloomy, because I think there are bloggers and digital ways of covering communities that I think will do some of what a local newspaper used to do and do it well. But I think there's a real concern now that things like courts and councils and public authorities are just not going to be covered, because bloggers can't do that. The fear, which is pretty widespread in America now, is that that will lead to an era of corruption. There seems to be an exact correlation between the free press and the amount of corruption in a country. What's to be done? Well, I think you have to, just as we have public service broadcasting in this country, I think a lot of people now are interested in this concept of public service reporting. So if local newspapers can no longer afford to do it, we have to ask whether public service reporting is, in the terminology of the moment, a public good which can't be provided by the market. If that's so, then is there a kind of subsidy? I mean, I think the most interesting idea at the moment is that the Press Association might be the contractor. So if there was a sum of money available, probably less than 100 million, but not much less, then the PA, you could draw up a list of courts and councils and authorities that society wanted covered, and the PA could then be the contractor. I think in the PA's imagination, they could then subcontract quite a lot of that to local papers. And local papers could then cover these councils with a subsidy, but having to face up to the fact that they would then have to share that with everybody.
Public subsidy for any kind of business is a hard sell, but particularly for the journalism business, which, and you can join the dots with another issue that's been going around recently, the issue of trust in journalism because of some of the practices of journalists. Do you think it's possible to convince a sceptical public that this sort of thing, that public subsidy for the business of journalism, is justified?
Well, I mean, it's there in the BBC. I mean, the BBC is public subsidy, and I think the BBC is the finest news organisation in the world. So that So it works as a model. Reuters is it's not public subsidy, but it's a very fine organization, a bit like the PA. Effectively, the ITV News was a public subsidy, and no one, I think, thought that ITV News was compromised by that. I mean, I think the local newspapers, when people started talking about this, were anxious about that. The idea of the PA receiving the subsidy is that I think it deals with that problem of local newspapers feeling they didn't want to have any kind of grant. I think if there is money available, all those local newspapers who a year ago were saying, oh, we would never touch money, if they saw independent TV producers or independent consortia saying, oh, well, actually, if local newspapers don't want this money, we will, I think local newspapers would soon change their tune.
How urgent do you think this is? You talked about the consequences being a rise in the level of corruption. Do you think this is something that needs to be addressed pretty quickly?
I think MPs have not begun to wake up to what's going on. I think probably at local council level, they're aware of the problem. Certainly judges and magistrates are aware that their courts are not being covered. That to my mind, is a catastrophe in terms of the role, why people cover courts and that business of, effectively, naming and shaming people who end up in courts. So I think at the local level, there's beginning to be an awareness of it, though I think they're a bit suspicious of local newspapers crying wolf and thinking, but you've always made fat money in the past. But I think as more and more newspapers start to close and the wreckage of the industry that you see in America threatens to come over and hit the local press here, which it will do, then I think MPs will wake up to the urgency of this question.
Alan Rusbridge is there. Janine, I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree with the analysis of the problem, but what about the solution of public subsidy? This is, as I put to Alan, is a hard sell, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's intensely problematic. It's quite intensely problematic for us. I don't think we're going to sit here and disagree vehemently with our boss. and it's worth saying that up front. However...
Well, no, I mean, I'm sure if we can perfectly have a reasonably have a grown-up discussion about the principles that he puts forward.
Yeah, no, I'm going to fight out some areas that I think are interesting, indeed challenging, about the proposition, because he's absolutely right. There are genuine threats to democracy if you accept that all local journalism just dies and say, well, that's it, the market can't provide, and so long, thanks for all the fish. And court reporting and council reporting are things that are absolutely intrinsic to democracy and that you want to sort of police and keep an eye on. However, whether subsidising local newspapers is a possible thing to achieve, let alone the right thing to do, is a really big question. In the short term, subsidising PA may well be the best way to ensure that you can physically have a presence in a courtroom or at a council meeting. I think that's quite a neat way of doing it. It's reasonably neutral. Nobody's seriously questioning PA's journalistic practices. It's not News International. Not that, I'm questioning News International at this juncture, I hasten to add. But in the medium to long term, you have to hope that something more sustainable could be done. And I think that, these events are recorded. There are court reporters. There are people in council meetings taking minutes. These things are documented and evidence, a notice taken. I think the bigger argument is the one that says these are public records that should be in the public domain. Mm. So actually, if all court proceedings were published, then we would be able to see them without the cost of having to send somebody there. And that actually becomes a sort of digital democracy issue. It's a sort of, free our data. It may not be data in the sense of numbers, but it is actually public data.
Well, it's data in the sense of information, isn't
information.
It? Stephen Brook, it's undoubtedly this is a serious problem, but you can't make people buy local papers, can you? If they don't want to buy local papers and they don't want to watch the ITV regional news, no amount of public subsidy is going to change that.
Exactly, and numbers are declining in terms of audience for both media. But what we've also got to remember is how did we get into this state? Because some of these companies and institutions aren't blameless. ITV, massive amount of debt. Local newspaper companies, Trinity Mirror, NewsQuest, et cetera, massive amounts of debt. And also, I think we can use the word greedy, a very greedy desire to have massive profit margins. So really squeeze these local papers, a lot of which, despite the recession, are still very profitable. Hmm. But because of the demands that have been put on them by the local companies, and at the end of the day, you could argue shareholders, because most of them are public companies, the model is broken. But smaller companies such as Ray Tyndall, which are, you know, a bit more modest in their ambitions and demand for profits, are actually doing quite well. So I would argue, before we get to this question of public subsidies, have we really taken a good hard look at the way these companies have run or allowed themselves to get into this state?
Mm. But let's be clear, because we're not actually, nobody, I don't think, is arguing to for a grant to Trinity Mirror, Johnson Press, or indeed Guardian Media Group. What Alan seems to be saying is we need to ensure that these things can be reported. So let's try and find the most neutral way of doing that that doesn't feel like you're subsidising shareholders in a sort of car industry bailout way, because that clearly is unsustainable. You can't be bailing out media groups. They've all had a lovely time in the times of plenty. Thank you very much.
Well, it's what we've been criticising everybody else for, isn't it?
And I also wonder
We could not sit here after all the grief we've given Channel 4 and now turn around and go, oh, it's our turn.
Well,
it's about £100 million, I think, that we're talking about. Well, what is it with £100 million?
It's the new million pounds.
It is. go on. I was interrupting you, Stephen. Sorry.
You did. I was just going to make the point, how can you, in whatever way, provide these institutions, whether it be PA, with money and then not compromise their independence? Because everywhere that we've seen where the government has in some way set up funds, or the example of the BBC was made, but they have lots of fights with the government.
Now, listen, this has been exercising people on the Media Guardian blog. Chaz One said, journalism has always flourished away from central sources. Local newspapers have failed to respond to the challenges of the marketplace. Pleading for taxpayers to fund substandard journalism is hardly an impressive pitch. Zootopian said, how about the national newspapers, BBC and PA, paying for all the stuff that they simply rehash for free from the local press? That would go some way to bridging the funding gap. And don't get me started on the treatment of local newspapers by their conglomerate owners, Guardian and MEN, anyone. You can read plenty more comment and analysis on this at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, it's been a quietish week in media land, but let's mop up some of the other stories. Brookie, starting with Fleet Street. Now, at the time of podding, sadly, there's still no verdict in the Desmond libel trial, so we're going to have to leave that one alone. But there's much that could be said about that story, but not for now, sadly.
Well, you can go and read all our coverage on the site if you want to. It's been rather colourful.
Can we not comment at all?
Well, there is a jury. We'll see what you have to say, and then I'll decide whether we take it out or not.
Okay.
Go on. What would you like to...
Possibly it says something about your defence when your lawyer's summing up says, all right, well, if you must find in favour of him, then just don't give him very many damages.
Yes.
What kind of faith is that?
Yeah, the lawyer did suggest that the jury could award the cover price of the Daily Express in damages.
Yes, well, 40p. It is the juror's equivalent. It's the verdict equivalent of, oh, a plague on both your houses.
Yes, well, we'll see what happens. keep up to date with that on Media Guardian. Mail Online has taken the top spot in the ABCEs, 29.3 million. Unique users, all of them angry about their wheelie bins. Martin Clark, who's the editor of Mail Online, well, I'm sure quite a lot of them are, has been calling for a more transparent way, seriously, there is an issue here, of measuring online success. This is the point that you'll be very familiar with as editor of Guardian.co.uk, Janine, that not all users are equal, that some people come in and all they read is one article and they've come in from Google or whatever and they go away again after they've finished reading that article, and others, the more loyal readers, as Martin Clark calls them, who he says 25% of the Mail's UK unique users are made of these people who come in and stay, and they read several articles a day, and there's no way of making any distinction between those two types of people.
So there are almost as many metrics for online audiences as you can imagine. You can measure number of pages read, number of page impressions, number of views, number of unique users, number of monthly unique users. I mean, you did time spent on site. And there are flaws with each of them as individual metrics because, you know, time spent on site... I can make the time spent on site metric really, really high by putting a paywall in front of it, because frankly, if you've paid, then you're going to spend a lot of time on the site. Any one of these metrics on their own is not going to work. You sort of need a combination of a few, and the fact is, Martin is completely right. We all know the limitations of the monthly unique user metric. However, you sense that quite a lot of these things are going to become irrelevant due to the phenomenal momentum around paying for content. You know, that sense that any minute now some media organisation is going to take that leap will actually, I mean, that's just going to change the idea of, we're only interested in metrics because we just show them to advertisers. If you're charging for content, then really your only metric you're interested in is your revenue.
And as you've brought it up, we might as well address it. There is a real momentum behind this now, isn't there?
Well, this is what I read and what I hear. Everybody's asking the question, and I sort of get the sense as a onlooker that there's a real kind of, who's going to go first? And if that happens, then you suddenly, I mean, only the people that are free will be interested in metrics, really.
And it's going to be News International. The answer to that question is News International, isn't it, Brookie?
Yeah, and the reason is because Rupert Murdoch has pushed them into it slightly, I think, against their desires, but he wanted it to happen. And what does he do when he wants something to happen? He says it publicly, and then everyone's got to scramble to make it happen. I think whilst the talk is there, there is still that kind of last gap in terms of how do we implement it, and there's got to be that courage to take the step and announce it.
All right,
and then, of course, you know, unique news figures will plunge when that occurs. I think that media companies are just hoping that they'll find solace in the money that comes in.
All right, well, watch this space. We mentioned this at the start of the podcast. Journalism, according to a new report, is one of the most exclusively middle-class professions. The report was called Unleashing Aspiration. Stephen, it's interesting you're an outsider to the British class system. Do you notice in your journalistic career in the UK that it is a middle-class profession?
Oh, totally, totally. I think anywhere you look, it's also south of England as well, overwhelmingly. I think that it's also very white, overwhelmingly. Hmm. I think, there is a bit of a conveyor belt which involves Oxbridge and then, you know, coming down and getting jobs. And how do you break into journalism if you are a graduate and you want to get in? I think that you can do very well on your student newspaper and get noticed, but it just helps if you know someone who knows someone who can put in a good word for you. Plus, you've got to be extremely keen. I think this is more a problem in television, although regional newspaper journalism, which has often been a feeding ground for the nationals, pays so badly that if you can't, you can't afford to do it unless you have help from your parents. That's the sort of sad truth.
The trouble, Janine, though, is that we've talked about these sorts of issues, whether it's class or race, with in terms of the BBC and the structures were put in place to try and improve that. The trouble is with journalism outside the BBC, there is no sort of career professional structure because there's no professional body or nobody works together. So it's very difficult to get anything done across the industry.
This is all true. And as somebody so middle class, I would have to describe myself as self-hating white middle class. And the only consolation I can offer is that the sort of exclusively middle class profession only works if it's so aspirational and so desirable that demand exceeds supply of job. And journalism and the media is, see all previous journalism that we've been doing on this show, about to become such a cataclysmically unprofitable business to be in, and therefore an unpalatable place to be employed, that the solution's right around the corner.
Mary Poppins, I am not.
The Job Interview from Hell, or the party political broadcast of your nightmares. The forthcoming series of The Apprentice is being mired in BBC bureaucracy and party politicking. It's all coming back, of course, because the programme's iconic host, Sir Alan, or Lord Alan Sugar, we should call him now, has recently been given a peerage and appointed as Gordon Brown's Enterprise Czar. Bonus point, by the way, if you can name the area from where he's taken his baronetcy.
He's the Baron Alan of Clacton, isn't he?
You're reading that, Clapton.
No, I'm not reading it. That's why I got it wrong. I would have been able to read it correctly.
Clapton in the London Borough of Hackney. I am one of his subjects, you see.
Right.
Well, I live in Clapton.
Baron Allen.
No, that's... I'm Baron Allen.
He's my... What?
Baron Allen, with no vowels. Baron Allen.
Yes, that's how it's going to work, I think. Anyway, after a load of badgering from the Conservatives, the BBC Trust said it wants BBC bosses to reschedule the series if and when an election is called, so any issues of partiality are avoided. Also this week, in other reality show news, the Big Brother is on the skids. Mark Lawson has called time on the iconic series in Friday's Guardian. Now, in no way is this the sound of the bottom of the barrel being scraped for topics for this week's podcast. But Janine, on The Apprentice first, is this just an easy way for the Tories to get some populist headlines, or do they have a point?
It's just the most ridiculous July story I've ever read, really. I can't even be bothered to be angry. I'm quite irritated.
But the BBC Trust has taken it seriously.
Oh, have they? Bollocks. They just wanted to look like they were responding to something and we all fall for it and write about it. But it really is. Could you tell me when The Apprentice is scheduled normally? As a general rule, don't think about it, just tell me, when is The Apprentice on?
The summer.
No, wrong.
Quite.
Wrong. It's scheduled sort of around March, isn't it?
Right.
Who cares? I agree. So at some point next year, there might be a general election. And at that point, we won't have a series of The Apprentice.
How does
anybody know?
Story, but my question about it is, why are the Tories bothering?
Well, yes, leaving aside the question of why we would decide to vote based on what Alan Sugar says to a bunch of marketing no-marks fanning about making
which
coffee.
Which is taped a year or 6 months earlier, yeah. Anyway. This is just the Tories being ridiculous and trying to put one over the BBC.
There are so many people being ridiculous in this story, it's almost impossible to pick out the first one who is at the heart.
I did, some considerable time ago, in the introduction to this section, mention...
Lord, yes, we did do that.
...mention Big Brother. Which Mark Lawson's getting all exercised about.
Wouldn't it be refreshing if we didn't discuss this? Wouldn't it just be lovely if we just went, it's dead?
We
moved on
very quickly. All we need is Big Brother dead or not. Janine... Have you been watching Big Brother this year?
No.
It's dead.
Exactly.
There we are. Whatever your views on this, you may post your comments on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Now, it's almost time to leave, but before we do...
We love the summer.
It is very much. Do you know? Last year we took a break in August, but I've decided this year, as we have competition,
because there was so much clamour for us discussing some made up nonsense from the tabloids.
Well, I was worried because other media podcasts are now available 52 weeks a year.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Which one's that then?
Well, Auntie Hewlett's one over at Radio 4.
The breakaway one.
So we're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle on through August.
Have we sued him yet? That would be a court case. That would rival Desmond versus Bauer, wouldn't it?
For breach of contract.
Yeah.
All right. Listen. There is a final
item on the agenda.
Closing item.
Oh, sorry.
Which is
sorry.
This is how we close the show. Now we ask you, what have we learned this week, Stephen? What did you learn this week?
Trying to find something I learned off the internet.
Well, I've learned two things,
right.
But I'm only giving you one, and I'm trying to work out which one
you could give the
you.
Other one to Janine.
Yeah, he's learnt one for me.
Oh, okay, yeah, I will do that. I've learnt that the biggest hit on Australian television for years and years and years, beating Big Brother, Australian Idol, Australia's Got Talent, with an incredible 3.7 million people tuning into the final, and an amazing 11 million people watching it over the course of the series, which is 50% of the Australian population, was MasterChef Australia.
I didn't realise 50% of the Australian population actually had televisions. Janine, what...
Is that a sheep joke?
What are you, or indeed, as producer Ben has just said, or even knew where the on button was. I had to attribute that joke. I couldn't possibly take credit for it myself.
Just typical of your middle-class patronising.
Yes, it is. Janine, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week, courtesy of Twitter trending topics, I learned this week that of all the Disney Channel's current crop of stars, I'm more like Miley Cyrus than Demi Lovato.
It's obvious I don't have children. I've no idea what you're talking about.
Matt, what did you learn this week?
Well, I learned that Jonathan Ross's star has fallen so low that he's been replaced as the grand opener of the Hampstead Garden Suburbs Horticultural Society's annual show by Henry Kelly.
Ooh. Hot knowledge. I like that one.
Now, listen, we're also on Facebook and Twitter, but then, we're cool like that. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Janine Gibson and the Dubrovnik Bound, Stephen Brook. Enjoy your holiday.
Thank you.
Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. See you next week.